Good morning.
Good morning, David.
Yeah. How's everybody doing?
Can I ask that everyone on this meeting, if you're not speaking, mute your microphone? That will ensure that we don't have a lot of switching on the meeting.
Good morning. Can everybody hear me? All right, we're going to get started. I believe everybody is here, looks like. Dwayne, are you ready? Is it being recorded?
We're good to go.
Okay, great. Okay, I'd like to call the February 8th, 2021 Pension Committee meeting to order. As permitted by the governor in order to limit the risk of potential COVID-19 exposure, our Pension Committee today is being held virtually. The public was encouraged to participate on our website. You can see the broadcast there. Okay, so the first item on the agenda is the approval of the November 19th, 2020 minutes. Is there any questions or concerns about the minute? Okay, hearing none, they'll stand approved. The next item on the agenda is the update on the pension and OPEB performance reports. We do have Pat Wing here of Marquette Associates. And before he starts, I did notice in the quarterly report that he has become a managing partner of Marquette. So I just want to say congratulations. All right, Pat, you can begin.
Go ahead.
You can share your video or share your screen, right?
Yes, and thank you for the kind words, Gina. I appreciate that. It's not something I was going to cover in the book.
I saw, yeah.
Let's see here. Okay, bear with me for one moment, please. Okay. Can everyone see my screen there, the report?
Yes.
Okay, great.
Yes.
Well, good morning, everyone. It's nice to see you virtually, at least. Hopefully, by May or minimum August, we'll be able to get back together in person. But with all that said, we have a pretty light agenda for today, particularly in light of the approved changes last year to infrastructure. I'll give you a quick update on the timing of that shortly. But as you all well know, we'd like to start out with our market environment presentation for an overview of what's going on in the economy, what's going on in markets, and provide context for how and why the pension and the OPEB funds performed the way they did, and also how some of the investment managers themselves performed the way they did given the market environment. So with all that said, we'll start out with the economy. You can see here on page 6, the top chart. This is one that we show every quarter. It's just a simple chart, real economic growth in the U.S. The bars are the quarterly numbers, where the striped bars are economists' estimates moving forward. And the orange line is the year-over-year number. So if we focus on the last two fully colored in bars, the blue bars, we know that Q3, we had a very strong rebound from the precipice that we fell off in Q2 as the economy began to reopen a little bit. We had a fairly considerable slowdown in the fourth quarter, as you might rightly expect, given the massive rebound in Q3, but the economy still grew at a pretty healthy rate of about 4%. And you can see as we head into 2021 here, the current projection is for somewhat of a slowdown in the first quarter. You know, we still have some scattered lockdowns and quarantines throughout the U.S., and the toll that will take on growth in the first quarter. But as the economy hopefully continues to rebound, reopen, the vaccine continues to get distributed, economists are expecting a pretty strong rebound for the rest of the year, mainly on three key areas. Number one, consumer spending has been strong, is expected to continue to be strong. Business investment, and finally, housing. Now, all that said, I'd be remiss not to mention, certainly, as you all well know, the policy support behind the strength in those three key areas has been nothing short of historic, any way you measure it. And we'll look at it more on a global stage in just a minute. But if we think about what's been occurring in the US, particularly how it's impacted the consumer, you can see the chart below where we're showing personal savings for the US consumer. And this really interesting chart on the bottom where you see this grayish row, that was the 12-month pre-COVID average monthly savings, around $100 billion. But then right after the pandemic kicked in, you could see savings here really shoot through the roof. And as you know, savings is just income minus spending. And we know spending really fell off a cliff in Q2 and slowly rebounded in Q3. So that would explain some of the increase. But we also know that there was a big loss in income, given what happened in the employment markets. So what this is really telling us is all those transfer payments from the government, notably from the CARES Act earlier last year, via stimulus checks, expanded unemployment benefits, really offset any lost income from the employment market. So now we're in a place where consumers are sitting on a ton of excess savings, as indicated by the sort of purple sand chart. These are the monthly savings in excess of that 12-month pre-COVID average. And I should note that this doesn't include the December package that was passed, the $900 billion package, and obviously doesn't include anything we're going to see out of Washington over the next month or so, which seems to be moving forward rather quickly. So as we look ahead, the consumer's in a pretty good spot with all this pent-up demand and savings and additional transfer payments coming their way from these two more recent packages are only going to expand that. So once the economy continues to fully reopen, we fully expect a pretty strong year for economic growth in the U.S. For 2021. Now, on the business spending side, as I mentioned, it's also been a key area of strength. You know, the prospects continue to look good, namely because business was really cut back on employment and capital spending amid the downturn, as we know. So this top chart here, I think, is pretty interesting. It's a survey by the NFIB, the National Federation of Independent Businesses. They survey thousands of companies and businesses each month. And one of the questions they ask are related to their inventories. Namely, are your inventories too low, you know, indicative of they're going to have to scale up and restock and really spend on inventory accumulation, or are they too high, And you can see this line, this brownish line shows the difference. And right now, those reporting their inventories are too low are at multi-decade highs relative to those saying they're too high. So as we move forward, again, as the economy continues to reopen, not only are the consumers in a good shape to, you know, continue spending at a good clip, but businesses are going to have to spend and accumulate inventories to keep up with hopefully this sharp rebound in consumer spending. So two key areas of the economy that look, as we head into the rest of 2021, to provide really good tailwinds for overall economic growth within the U.S. From a global perspective, you can see this on page 8 here. You know, it's a similar story of what we saw in the U.S. You know, stimulus, not just inside the U.S., but outside the U.S. Here we're showing the darker pieces of this columns are monetary stimulus and the lighter blue fiscal stimulus. But outside the U.S. in key areas like the Eurozone, Japan, China, we've seen, again, sort of a historic response by policymakers to the downturn. And you can see cumulatively last year, and this does not include the package in December, more than $28 trillion in global stimulus from policymakers to support their respective economies amid the pandemic. And as we look ahead here, one of the key things that we're seeing out of China, you know, again, a big driver of economic growth like the U.S., is the consumers are in a similar position. We saw the savings rate for Chinese consumers really spike towards the early part of 2020 amid the pandemic. So again, as their economy, which has reopened, continues to reopen, Chinese consumers are sitting on a lot of excess savings. So again, it just augurs for a pretty strong rebound in consumer spending in China. And when you have such a strong outlook in not only China, but also the US, for the global economy, 2021 is looking to be a pretty strong year, given the consumers are in decent shape from a savings perspective, and given that the policy support seems to be coming, or at least seems no end in sight as we look forward here. Now, from a markets perspective, if 2020 has taught us anything, is that a calendar year between the economy and what happens in markets, there's little to no link, because we did have one of the biggest drawdowns from an economic perspective in the U.S. and globally that we saw in history, but markets actually ended up posting above average returns for the year. You can see the chart on the right here, we're showing in green the Q4 returns across a lot of major capital markets, and then those purple bars are the 2020 returns. So we'll focus on the green to begin with. You can see here U.S. equities were up just shy of 15% for the fourth quarter. International developed equities were up slightly more than that. And emerging market equities were actually the best of the bunch. So if we think about, you know, that relative performance in the fourth quarter, what we saw is those more cyclical or, you know, more volatile areas of the market do better. So emerging markets were certainly fit that bill. They're very volatile, aggressive part of the equity markets. And as the economy continues to recover, they outperform during that quarter, which is, you know, in line with what you would expect. It's a similar story in the fixed income markets. Here you see U.S. bonds up slightly for the quarter. So this is investment grade bonds like treasuries, investment grade corporates, mortgage backed securities. It's just up slightly. But then high yield bonds below, again, a more speculative, aggressive, sort of volatile area of the market, was up almost 7%. So when you think about high yield bonds, they tend to act somewhat of a, say, 50-50 proxy with investment grade bonds and equities. So their return sort of halfway in between what we saw from bonds and equities. So when equity markets are doing well, we would expect high yield bonds to do well, which is exactly what we saw. And then finally for this page for core real estate, the data isn't available when we put the chart together, but just to let you know, and we'll show this shortly, Clarion, the Lion Property Fund, the core real estate manager for the pension and the OPEB, was up just a shade under 2% for the quarter. So we've seen some stabilization in the core real estate markets, and Clarion again up just under 2% and well ahead of their peers, and we'll see that shortly. Now just to make a couple of quick comments on U.S. equity markets, you know, they comprise almost half of the pension and the OPEB, so we always like to take a look a little bit deeper. From a sector perspective, you see sector returns for the quarter and year-to-date up here. There's a lot of data, and admittedly, and I apologize, it's hard to see. But the key takeaways that I've mentioned from a broader equity perspective still hold true within the U.S. namely that the more cyclical, volatile areas outperform. So the leader here, you can see energy up 30% for the quarter on the back of a big rebound in oil prices. Similarly, financials up about 25% as interest rates, long-term interest rates increase just slightly. That tends to be a little bit of a tailwind for financials in a steepening yield curve. So they rally very, very strongly. And then other areas, more volatile, cyclical areas like industrials, materials did well. So when we think about this in context of the pension and the OPEB, from an investment manager point of view, you know, those more aggressive and volatile managers did well, like a Dodge and Cox that we'll see shortly. But as you know, we do take a more conservative stance from implementation. Said differently, we tend to use managers, if they're not passive, that are a little bit more defensively oriented. So capturing most of that upside, but really protecting on the downside. So in an environment where the cyclical, very volatile areas are outperforming, those managers made money, but generally lagged the broader equity markets. You know, a good name to exemplify this is MFS, the low volatility global equity manager that focuses away from those volatile areas like emerging markets, like energy, and more defensive areas of the market. So again, they made money, but lagged given places like emerging markets, places like energy really drove a disproportionate share of the gains. And then finally, quickly in the US equity markets, just want to mention thinking more about a look ahead here. You know, we've seen a strong rebound in prices for stocks, as you all well know. But importantly, that rebound has far exceeded the rebound we've seen in earnings expectations. So the earnings that these stocks are going to generate. So this top chart is showing the forward earnings expectations for the broad US equity market. You can see it troughed here in sort of Q2 of 2020 and has rebounded nicely since then. But earnings expectations for growth 12 months ahead are only in this sort of 25 to 30% range, whereas the price of stocks has gone up, say, 60 to 70% during that same period. So when you think about those pieces together, if the prices have gone up more so than the underlying earnings, that means the valuations have gone up. So markets have become more expensive. And we note that here in the second paragraph, you can see the forward price to earnings ratio ended the year at almost 24, which is only about 45% above its 20-year average. So we would expect that PE ratio to increase in the early parts of a recovery as, you know, stocks generally anticipate a rebound in earnings. But what this is telling us right now is in 2021, we're going to need to see that earnings growth of, say, 25 or even 30% for the market to continue really to rally here moving forward. And absent that, you know, we could certainly be in store for some more volatility this year. But when we think about, you know, all the pieces together, we do think markets are poised to continue their rally, but certainly with some volatility along the way as things happen from time to time, whether it be related to the vaccine rollout or other sort of unforeseen issues or shocks that we just don't know about right now. We could again see some volatility. However, we do think this year, maybe going into next year, the outlook for equity markets should be reasonable compared to history. Not necessarily the pace that we've seen since March, but hopefully some strong, maybe low double digits for equity markets in the year ahead. Now, all that said, we are seeing some signs of speculation in the market, which is generally indicative of sort of, you know, the top, if you will, of any long-term bull market. So I'm sure you've all seen in the news some interesting things happening with a handful of really small stocks, namely GameStop, if you have been following the news, where the share prices have just increased exponentially on the back of this sort of tug of war between retail investors and institutional investors, where the retail money is sort of ganged up on the institutions and drove in those prices very, very high, which negatively impacted institutional investors, namely some of the hedge funds. And we're seeing that in the handful of really small stocks that the outlook isn't particularly attractive for, but it seems like some money is flowing in some key areas, namely, you know, small stocks that where the prospects aren't great, or, you know, penny stocks, things of that nature, where retail is starting to really, you know, take some of that excess savings and actually put it into the market and trying to, you know, for lack of a better phrase, make a quick buck. So we are certainly monitoring those dynamics, because even though we do think the market outlook looks reasonable, as I mentioned a second ago, we want to be monitoring those sorts of pockets of speculation, because again, they have been, you know, within history, sort of signs that, you know, markets could be getting ahead of themselves and be a little bit vulnerable. So we're seeing a little bit of that, but not enough to make us, you know, overly concerned about some of those different aspects. So let me pause for a quick second, see if there are any comments or questions about the market environment before we move into the performance report itself. Okay. So let's start with the pension, and I will walk through the pension. As you know, normally we have a performance update for the preceding month, but we're meeting a little earlier this year. So I'll just make some quick comments on what we've seen so far year to date for the returns of the pension and the OPEB. So I'll walk through the pension in some detail, and then when we get to the OPEB, just do a quick high level, because the broad takeaways are all the same for the OPEB as they are for the pension. So when you see the observations here, and we'll show the data behind these shortly, the market value at the end of December was $138.2 million. There was an investment gain of $11.3 million in the fourth quarter. The fourth quarter return was 9.1% net of fees versus a policy index of 10.1. I talked a little bit about what were some headwinds for the pension relative to the policy, and I'll talk about more about that in just a second. And how fiscal year to date, we're up just under 15% for the pension versus a policy index of 16.5. So there's, you know, as you rightly know, maybe a little bit more than 4 months or 4+ months left in the current fiscal year. But not only did we see that gain through December, but as I mentioned, so far this year, markets have generally been strong as well. So when we put the pieces together, now the pension is up in the neighborhood of, say, 2.5% through last Friday. So fiscal year to date, we're up in the neighborhood of around 17.5%. So we have a good cushion as we close out the fiscal year here, trying to, you know, stay above that assumed rate of return of 7%, which, as you all well know, year in and year out, if you can come in above that assumed rate of return, that has positive implications for the funded ratio and then any calculated county contributions to the pension and the OPEB fund. So very strong for the pension from a return perspective relative to that assumed rate of return. Now, again, if we think about this 9.1 versus the 10.1, you know, how do we explain that, you know, 1 percentage point underperformance during the quarter? Well, it came from, you know, one key area. On the positive side, so what helped the pension versus that index was a couple of things. Number one, value tilt within U.S. equities there. You know, we've talked about this fairly regularly. We do have slight tilts to value stocks in the U.S. and non-U.S. for a couple of reasons. Number one, they've underperformed growth stocks for, geez, going on 7-10 years now, that they are trading at cheap valuations or less expensive valuations relative to growth and relative to the broad market. So we think a tilt towards those stocks certainly makes sense given that. And then secondly, what also helped was outperformance by Clarion, as I mentioned a second ago. On the negative side was underperformance by most of the active equity managers. So as I mentioned, most of these managers are more defensive in nature. You know, we've talked about regularly in the past trying to capture most of that upside, but really focus on that downside. And given that, again, most of the managers made money and captured much of that upside, but the environment itself, given more of those aggressive, cyclical, volatile areas outperformed, they generally underperform their broader market benchmarks. And finally, for Q4, we did make some manager changes. This was put forth in one of those weekly emails to the committee in the form of a memo, but I will speak to that in just a couple of minutes. And then looking ahead, we did get the paperwork in at the end of last year before the calendar year term for the new infrastructure investment with JP Morgan for both the pension and the OPEB. So now we're just waiting for JP Morgan to be ready to accept that money or call that capital that we made in the commitment and the agreement. And we expect that to happen in the back half of the year. So we'll continue to keep the committee apprised on the timing of that as we move forward. You see on page 19 here, this is really our executive summary page. So we start with the cash flow. So where were we and how did we get to where we are now? You can see in the fourth quarter there, we began with about $126.8 million. And then, you know, just some nominal cash flows, but the investment gain really driving the change there at $11.3 million. So we ended up essentially $11.3 million higher than where we began at the beginning of the quarter. And now you can see compared to fiscal year to date, the next column where we began about $128 million, the investment gain so far just in the back half of 2020, $17.6 million. So all told, we're about $17.7 million higher than where we began from a market value perspective in the fiscal year. So you see the returns in the middle of the page. I'm going to comment on them in more detail on in two pages when we shift gears. But I did want to mention the asset allocation versus the policy. So we ended the quarter with some overweights to the equity markets, specifically in the U.S. and non-U.S., and an underweight to real estate. You know, we continue to want to see some stabilization in real estate before we would commit to bringing that back to target. We've started to see that, but we really want to see it bear more fruit before we're comfortable making that decision. Most importantly, if you see all the way to the right here, every asset class in line with the approved ranges by the committee and council. So from an asset allocation perspective, everything is in line with the investment policy statement. Now on the next page here, this is a summary of cash flows. So we're focused on the bottom here, and you can see the beginning market value for all the respective investment managers in the pension, the net cash flows. So you can see a lot of numbers here. We were very active really in mid-December making some changes that were more consistent with, say, our long-term philosophy. And I'll speak more to that in just a second. But if you think about, you know, what came out and what went in from an investment manager perspective, you can see that here on the ending market value. So anywhere where you see a dashed line, that means the manager is no longer in the fund at the end of the quarter. So American Funds here was a name we removed from the pension. Von Tobel Global Equity, another name. And then Hartford International and Vanguard Total Stock. So four managers were removed towards the end of the quarter from the pension. And then as far as what took their respective places, anywhere you see a dashed line in this first column is a new manager. So you can see Artisan Global Opportunities, Dodge & Cox Global Stock, both global equity managers were added to the fund. And then on the international side, Fidelity Total International Index. This was an easier sort of straight swap with the Vanguard Index Fund that we did mainly for fee savings. Both of those are passive funds providing the same exposure to broad non-US equity markets, but the Fidelity fund is about 40% cheaper than the Vanguard fund, so we made that change for fee savings purposes. And then finally added the Hartford Schroders International Multicap Value Fund, and that was really a fallout adding that fund with the changes that we made in the global side, specifically adding Artisan and adding Dodge & Cox. So the impetus of the changes was to add more money to active global equity managers, because as we've talked about regularly in the past, we have had and our clients have had the most success in selecting and identifying managers that operate in the global space so they can invest anywhere in the US, internationally, and emerging markets where they see the best opportunities. And historically, they've been able to outperform the broad global equity benchmarks at a higher clip than, say, just a US equity manager or just an international manager. So we moved more funds to that global space via Artisan and Dodge & Cox, and the money to fund those investments would therefore have come from American Funds and then Hartford International Opportunities Fund. But again, the broad takeaway, taking money out of areas where managers are less likely to outperform, say the U.S. and international markets, moving those funds into the global equity space where, again, at least over the long term, those managers have tended to outperform over time. So now let's take a quick second looking at the returns of the pension relative to other defined benefit funds across the US. So, you know, we've talked about this page in the past, but just as a quick rehash, we use a third party platform called Investment Metrics to generate these reports. We use it along with, say, 50 other consulting firms. So all client data is anonymized, but it's available on the platform, giving us the opportunity to, say, slice and dice it and compare similar institutions. So here we're comparing the pension fund return to the peer set that's all public defined benefit funds. So it's the same institution. At the same time, we have to remember that all institutions are not the same, certainly. So, you know, what I mean by that is some have higher return targets for their actuary assumed rate of return. Asset allocation could be very different. The third main key component is funded ratios could be very different. So if you have a high assumed rate of return and a low funded ratio, you have to take a lot of risk to try and make up the ground. So there are key differences, which we should keep in mind. There's a lot of data on this page. So I'll focus on the bottom two rows here, where you see the circle and the X to the left. So the circle represents the total pension fund and the X is the policy index. So for the quarter, the 9.1 for the pension was below the median, similar to fiscal year to date. So I talked a lot about those headwinds as far as using managers that are generally more defensive. Again, they made a lot of money, but didn't necessarily keep pace with the benchmark. So that was certainly a headwind relative to policy and relative to the peer group so far in the back half of 2020. It's a similar story for the 1 year. When you look out later for 3 year, 3, 5, and 7, you can see those returns still, you know, generally behind that policy, but more in line with the median pension fund over those time periods. Now, certainly, you know, being in line with the median is admittedly okay. Generally, we want to be above that median. This back half of this year, with being a little bit more defensive, generally impacted not those short-term returns, you could see, but the longer ones as well. If we do experience sort of a volatile event or a drawdown in equity markets, then we would fully expect to be on the opposite side of that. Because as you know, as we talked about before, we're focused on that downside protection and upside participation. So over the past, you know, 6 months, it's been a sort of a one-way trip uphill for most markets, which is generally, you know, a headwind for how we typically invest the assets, which is a little bit more conservatively. Now, all that said, what I did want to point out to is on this page 24. You know, I talked a second ago about the key differences that we don't really see from a returns perspective from that previous page, right? You know, so asset allocation could be different, return targets could be different, funded ratios could be different. So on this page, we try to normalize for some of those differences. So what we're showing here is a similar peer ranking using returns, but instead of just returns, these are risk-adjusted returns, namely Sharpe ratios. So think about that as a measure of how much we're getting paid for the risk that we're taking. So obviously we want to get as paid as much as we can for the lowest amount of risk. So higher numbers here are better. And I think these numbers, again, sort of, you know, normalize some of the key differences across institutions where some are taking a lot more risks because they have higher assumed rate of returns, lower funded ratios, so they have to kind of claw their way out of a bad position. And given they're very, very risky and riskily invested, then on the previous page, when markets are doing very, very well, then they're going to outperform. But if we take into account or sort of adjust those returns for each institution's respective risk, then we can make more of an apples to apples comparison. So with all that said, if we look at some of these numbers, we're showing the Sharpe ratio for the pension versus the peer group over 3, 5, 7 years. For the 3 year period, the Sharpe ratio you can see here in 0.6. The relative ranking there is 58th, so just below the median there. And that was in line with the ranking on the 3 year. But when you look at those longer periods of 5 and 7 years, it becomes a little bit more favorable. Here you see the ranking over 5 year generally in line with the median, whereas on the previous page, it was the 62nd percentile. So you can see now for the returns that have been generated, they've been done so with less risk relative to the peer group, because now we're taking that risk into consideration. And then over the 7 years, a similar type story, now almost top third. So again, for how much return the pension has generated, it's been taking less risk relative to the peer group. So that risk-adjusted return is, again, you can see your top 36% relative to that peer group. And, you know, investing more conservatively and trying to generate, you know, good risk-adjusted returns is important for a couple of reasons. Number one, you know, that'll generally lead to more stable funded ratios over time as your assets don't generally be as volatile as maybe some other institutions out there. And then number two, if you have less volatile funded ratios, then you'll have less volatile contributions, right? When Chiron does the actuarial valuation reports with the smoothing from that lower volatility, you'll have generally more certain or more stable contributions. So that is a benefit of investing a little bit more conservatively, which as you can see here has been beneficial over the 7 years, but more short-term periods like the past 1 year and the past 3 years where markets have generally done very, very well, was a little bit of a headwind. So let me make a couple comments on the managers themselves, and then I'll pause quickly before we just take a 2 minute overview of the pension. So here we're showing in the brown bars, you can see the composite return. So anywhere you see these brown bars and composite, it's a weighted average of your equity manager returns here. So the total equity is a weighted average of US, global, and non-US, which is on the next page. And relative to that total equity policy index, you can see about 2 percentage points behind for the quarter. US equity composite was generally in line with that benchmark, and as you'll see on the next page, so was the non-US equity composite. So the big drag here was really in the global equity space. As I mentioned, we made some changes here, adding Artisan, Dodge & Cox, and removing Von Tobel, who's a more defensive manager, the latter Von Tobel. So I'll just make some comments around MFS and Schroeder, since they have been in the fund for around 2.5 years now. So you can see MFS here up 9%. So they were behind the broad global equity markets by about 6 percentage points. You see MSCI ACWI here for the quarter is up 15%. Now, again, MFS is a low volatility manager, more conservative, focusing on the more defensive areas of the market. Again, not the energies, not the financials, not the emerging markets, generally more stable areas of the market. So, again, they lagged given those aggressive and volatile areas outperformed. However, when we think about, you know, how is MFS doing to a benchmark that's really, you know, in line with its strategy, or say a peer group that does the same thing or attempts to do the same thing as them, you can see the secondary benchmark here, the MSCI ACWI Minimum Volatility Index, which is a broad global equity benchmark, again, looking at low volatility type stocks. MFS has been generally ahead of that and generally ranked favorably relative to their peer group here, the low volatility peer group, where again, lower numbers are better. So, you know, long-winded way of saying, you know, MFS underperformed. We would have expected them to do so given the market environment, but compared to what they're supposed to be doing from a benchmark perspective and a peer group perspective, still ranked generally favorably. Now for Schroeder's on the next page, this one is a similar story to MFS, but you know, admittedly, we would expect performance to be a little bit better, and we are taking a hard look at Schroeder's now. They are a global equity manager, again, focused on quality companies, so again, a little bit more defensive than the broad global equity market, but not as defensive as MFS. You can see Schroeder's was up a little bit more than MFS, but admittedly, we would have expected them to probably be more in this 11 to 12% range, you know, capturing more of that upside. So their performance was a little bit disappointing. Even though they're more defensive posture, they tend to lean towards value stocks, which did do well. So their main detractors during the quarter was generally from a stock selection perspective. Again, you know, we would have expected them to do a little bit better given the market environment. So we're taking a look at them, you know, do they still deserve a place in the global equity segment of the pension and the OPEB, you know, moving forward here. So that's one area that we're looking at over the next couple of months. As I mentioned, on the non-US equity side, returns pretty much in line with the composite. So the main drag from equity market perspective was on the global side. Real estate, as I mentioned, clearing up 1.7%, well ahead of the benchmark and well ahead of the peer group. They continue to benefit from overweights to the industrial segment of the core real estate market and an underweight to retail. So really the two key areas that are at the opposite end of the spectrum. Industrial, which continues to do very, very well, and retail, which has been really under secular or sort of structural decline even pre-pandemic, which is, seems to have been exacerbated by the pandemic itself. And given those two relative, you know, one over and one underweight, being overweight a segment that's done well, an underweight a segment that hasn't done well, that's allowed them to generate good, solid relative performance compared to that peer group. And then finally, on the fixed income side, you can see more or less in line with the benchmark for all short and longer term type periods, as you all well know. Yeah, we take a more conservative approach to fixed income. Generally, we view that as the insurance for the fund. And what I mean by that, when equities aren't doing well, generally we like to have sort of safer type fixed income so that you can cash in that insurance if equities do see a downturn and use that money for any, say, liquidity needs, or in a perfect world, to rebalance back into equities after they've declined. So we like to have it be a little bit more conservative to make sure we can actually cash in that insurance when and if we need it most. So let me pause for a quick second, see if there are any comments or questions around the pension before I do a quick 2-minute overview on the OPEB. Okay, so I'll just focus here on the observations page and the main summary page here, because the takeaways for the OPEB are generally pretty much all the same as the pension, along with the changes that were made in December. So you can see at a high level here for the observations for the OPEB, the fund ended December at just a shade under $55 million, had an investment gain during the quarter of a little north of $4.5 million. And you can see the Q4 return was a little bit better than the pension at 9.3. There are slight differences in the global equity structure and namely the fixed income structure that proved to be a little bit more beneficial for the OPEB. So that explains that 0.2 percentage points higher performance for the OPEB relative to the pension, not only for the quarter, but also for the fiscal year as well. And just like the pension, the OPEB is probably up in the neighborhood of 2.5 percentage points so far through last Friday. So fiscal year to date here again, up about 17.5%, again, well north of that assumed rate of return. And I talked about the implications and the benefits of that a few minutes ago. The attribution, again, generally the same because they are invested very similarly. We made equity manager changes, again, very similar in vein to the ones I talked about on the pension side. And then again, we did get that JP Morgan paperwork done at the end of December. So we expect JP Morgan to ask for or call that money for investment in the back half of this year. We'll have more clarity around the timing of that in the coming months. So just to wrap up here, again, because the rest of the deck here fully falls in line with the pension, we'll take a look at just the high level information, and then I'll pause for any comments or questions. So you can see on the summary of cash flows, we began the quarter about $50.2 million. Net investment gain of 4.6. So we ended the quarter about $4.6 million higher than where we began. And then fiscal year to date, similar story, an investment gain of about $7.1 million. So the fund so far, 6 months into the fiscal year, again, up about $7 million from where we began. I mentioned the returns a second ago, a little bit more favorable from the OPEB as far as our Q4 fiscal year to date and 1 year. So those rankings I talked about from the pension will be a little bit more favorable relative to the peer group. For the OPEB relative to the pension, because again, some slight tweaks in global equities and fixed income were a little bit more favorable for the OPEB. And then similar, you look at the asset allocation, broad takeaways, very much in line, slight overweights to US, non-US equities heading into the quarter so far this year. And again, a slight overweight to real estate. We've seen the stabilization in the markets, which we're very happy about, but we want to see a little bit more confirmation that that trend is going to continue before we, move that allocation back in line with the policy. So, in other words, given the uncertainty, we'd rather be a little late than early. So we're continuing to monitor those developments and are talking about it internally, but for right now, we're gonna pause and, bringing that back in line with policy. But at the end of the day, you see all the way to the right here, the policy ranges, again, as approved by the committee, approved by council. All the asset allocation is in line with those respective ranges as indicated by these green yeses up and down the table from top to bottom there on the right. So all that said, let me pause. That wraps up my prepared comments, but happy to answer any questions or comments from the committee or staff on anything that I discussed.
This is Dave. I have a question about the fixed income investments in the pension fund. We've got about $10 million in the Fidelity Intermediate Treasury Bond Index Fund. Given current economic projections, and what are your thoughts about staying with that much in intermediate bonds?
Yeah, it's a great question, Dave. So, you know, a couple of quick things. So from an interest rate perspective, the Fed has made it abundantly clear that they are not going to be raising short-term interest rates anytime soon. Now, that said, intermediate and sort of longer-term rates march to the beat of their own drum. So we do think that they could rise as we head through 2021, given the economic strength that we see. We don't think that they're going to rise to the level, say, you know, a 10-year at 2.5% by any stretch of the imagination. But you raise a good point. So what we've been doing, I pulled this page up on page 36, Dave, you know, we have internal targets to these managers, respected managers, and we have been running an underweight to those bonds. You can see here at 7.6 versus an 8% target. And in relation to that, running overweights to Lord Abbott and Chartwell, which are more short-term managers that operate in the 1-3 space and not focused just on treasuries, but things like investment-grade corporates, mortgage-backed securities, high-yield bonds, and things like that. So we are definitely implementing that view here between underweighting Fidelity and overweighting those more short-term managers. And to your point, I expect that probably to continue and maybe even be a little bit more pronounced. In other words, continue to draw down this Fidelity allocation and move it into the short-term managers where the risk of interest rates rising isn't nearly as big. Now, all that said, we do think an allocation to Fidelity or some allocation to 5-10-year treasury bonds are extremely important because they are the insurance, right? In the first quarter of last year, when equity markets were down 20-some-odd%, those intermediate treasury notes were up in the order of 6-7%, and we used a lot of those gains to rebound. So, you know, in isolation, the risk reward isn't great, and we're going to continue to run that underweight. But from a total portfolio perspective, we think it still plays a very important role. So if we do get an equity sell-off, treasury rates we would expect to fall and then rebalance out of there and hopefully be able to buy equities after they decline when it become a little bit cheaper.
So Pat, your overweight to short term is to be able to take advantage of equity or rates as they move?
And rates as they move. So if rates are going higher, we're underweight the intermediate space here and overweight the short term space here. So if we do see rates rise, then having that relative over and under underweighting would protect the fund since we have less duration than the benchmark itself.
So it's more defense than offense.
It's more defense than offense within fixed income itself, right? When we're just thinking about fixed income and the prospects of rates rising, it's more defense, right? We're lowering that interest rate risk. If we think about it in the total portfolio perspective, that's what I mentioned a second ago, even though we think rates could rise, we still want to hold a decent amount to those treasury bonds because they're the insurance themselves. Does that make sense? Am I answering the question?
I think so. And one follow-up then, you know,
sure.
If the Fed says they're not going to raise rates for a couple of years, do we need all the defense now?
Do we need all the defense from the Fidelity perspective?
From the short duration.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, at least I think I do. So I think what we're saying is that the Fed controls short-term interest rates, as we all well know, and there seems to be no prospect of them increasing anytime soon. But what we have seen, let me back up here, see if I can find the appropriate page that I skipped. What we have seen as far as the yield curve, we did see some steepening. So those short-term rates here between 0 and 5 were basically the same. So this purple line is the yield curve as of December and the green line as of 9/30. So even though the Fed is not going to be raising short-term rates anytime soon, and we wouldn't expect rates to move too much in the 0 to 5 range, longer term rates could see some upside if the economy continues to strengthen, if inflation comes in a little hotter than expected. So we do think being a little bit more defensive, having that underweight to intermediate treasury bonds within the context of fixed income makes sense, because this purple line could eventually continue to move up ever so slightly, even though the Fed is intent on not raising short-term interest rates anytime soon. Does that answer your question, Mitch?
I guess so. And just, you know, we say on my side of the fence, there's no income in fixed income. So we're you know, you're not shooting for yield. You're shooting to make money off the bonds, the alpha that you had, or that the managers had.
Exactly. So as you rightly point out, in the Fidelity, even though they're longer term bonds in that 5 to 10 year range, they're treasuries. So those short term managers, even though they're 1 to 3, they have much more credit exposure to corporates, high yield mortgages, commercial mortgage backed securities. So they're actually out yielding the treasury bonds anywhere in the neighborhood of maybe 1 to 1.5 percentage points. So there's some pickup and additional yield on that short term, on their short term managers as well.
If I can switch gears on you a little bit, you said equity growth this year, you're expecting low double digits, which means 10 to 15% on the equity side.
Right. That's our expectation right now. You know, admittedly, I think the path to get there is going to be pretty interesting, hopefully not as interesting as it was last year. But that's our general expectation as things stand right now. You know, we think earnings growth is going to come in, you know, in this sort of 25 to 35% range. So even though those multiples are very high, if you have that sort of earnings growth, even if multiples come down by, you know, 10, 15, 20%, then, you know, your earnings growth coupled with your dividends still gets you in that 10, 12, 15% range. So that's our expectation as things stand today. Any other comments or questions from the committee?
Are you planning any changes now, Pat? Or anything in the wind?
So I think to answer you, Dave, you know, one of the things where we're looking at is when the infrastructure is called later this year, hopefully in the July to September time horizon, that will obviously necessitate some changes. You know, we're pulling that money, some from fixed income, some from equities. So that will be a change. And then in addition to that, in the global equity space, as I mentioned, Schroeder's really has underperformed our expectations over the past few months. So I think there's a decent probability that we swap them out on the pension side and look for a different active global equity manager. So those are really the two big things as we look forward out over the next 3-6 months or so.
Anybody else have any more questions? All right, hearing none. Thank you, Pat.
Thank you.
All right. Does any of the committee members have any questions, general questions before we adjourn?
No.
Okay. Hearing none, do I have a motion to adjourn?
Make that motion.
Okay. I have a motion from Ms. Brewington, a second?
Second.
And I have a second. All right, all in favor say aye.
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 All right, thank you. We're adjourned.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you, everyone.